Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
I'm John Williams. We're in the Allstate Showcase studio here on Michigan Avenue. Tom Hush is producing today. Producer Griffin is on the road, though we'll connect at least with his famous movie list. You know, Griff is endeavoring to watch a movie a day for 2018. And by golly, it looks like he's going to get it done. If January is any measure, a movie a day. We are printing his week-by-week summaries, and the latest is up on my Facebook page. I'm WGN King John there. Now, if you've been listening this morning or to us the last week or so, you know that today is Sam Panayanovich's last day on the Saturday-Sunday gig. He'll do Dean Richards' show tomorrow. Sam is going to work for the Sirius Satellite Network out of Las Vegas, doing something that he is uniquely qualified for. Sports, betting, lines. You're going to have a great time out there. So Brenda tells me, hey, Lou is really doing it up. They've got chicken and waffles and sandwiches.
They have their chicken dinner hoodies on.
Hoo-ha. I wore my chicken dinner t-shirt last week. Shortly after it was announced. I'm wearing a suit today because I have to give a speaking engagement. I just feel like I'm not doing you properly. And Lou casts a pretty big shadow, you know?
It's not a competition. It really isn't.
So I felt real terrible about this. And I was going to run over to Walgreens. And then I thought, well, how much in a gift card do I get you? And then I thought of something different. Domati, do you have the envelope that I asked you to hold on to?
I do have the envelope.
Why don't you stand up, Domer, and walk in and give it to Sam. I'd like him to open it if you don't mind.
This is fun.
They're in adjacent studios. This will just take about 5 seconds. Domati is now handing it to...
A blank check?
Well, I don't know that it's a blank check. Why don't you just go ahead and open that, young man?
Okay. Yeah, Domati won't leave.
Don't read the names on it, but just read the number on it.
You want me to read your address?
No, just read the number on it.
How about the routing number?
It's a check, and how much is that check for, my friend?
Let's see. The check is for... Are you serious?
What does it say?
$800.
I found it in the parking lot this morning.
So it's not for me.
No, it's from one guy to another guy, and it's in, but it's endorsed.
Oh, this is great. Yeah, you know, I was really hoping for a check for $800 for somebody that I'm not. Do you have to turn this into the feds? Like, what do I do?
I think you can go.
Am I responsible for this now?
It's endorsed, so you can kind of do whatever you want with it.
I don't want to get in trouble.
No, you don't.
Well, thanks for this.
I mean, thanks for this.
The check, by the way, is also ripped. There's a little rip at the bottom.
I believe both of you are now complicit in a federal crime, incidentally.
Well, Sam, that's what you get for those for that Trump Hotel soap gift you gave John.
Remember when you went out to Vegas? You gave me a gift bag of every Trump-labeled tchotchke that they hand out in the hotel.
Yes, I did.
Soap, shampoo, facial scrub, hair net.
This is funny. This president
is pretty
funny.
In your face, Panayanovich.
$800.
Just somebody just... We don't need to bother Lou with the details, but run down the hall and just go, oh, by the way, Lou, John gave Sam $800. It wasn't John's. Incidentally, the name's on that check. It's one corporation check to another corporation, and the treasurer signed it, and then he dropped it on the street by the Dunkin' Donuts downtown. We'll make sure the check finds its rightful owner.
We or me?
Well, I'm an accomplice, too. I feel like I got to help you figure this out.
That's very clever. I give you kudos for that one, though. That's funny.
I could have kept it. I'm just saying.
Well, my eyeballs got super big when I saw, because I looked right to the price.
Oh, buddy, I'm sorry. Listen, I didn't mean to.
You got me right there.
I don't mean to break your heart or disappoint you. I didn't give you $800.
No, it's fine. I just won't do your show ever again.
Oh, no, you won't. Hey, do you guys watch Jeopardy with any regularity?
Not regularly, but I watch it.
Okay, so this is Super Bowl week, and everything in America is Super Bowl themed. So on Jeopardy, they did a series of questions about the Super Bowl. This made some news this week because, you know, they are just a little snooty, I think, on Jeopardy. They're so damn smart. And if you aren't smart enough, every now and then Alex Trebek turns on you. Well, you've got a bunch of dweeby geeks there who are really super smart, and they knew Elizabethan literature and physics and a bunch of other worthless stuff. But these people don't know anything about football. And so the internet was abuzz with Trebek essentially trolling the contestants that were right in front of him. I'm going to play for you the five questions that he asked them that they were unable to answer. Let's see how well we do.
Football 200.
Your choice, do or don't name this play in which the quarterback runs the ball and can choose to pitch it to another back.
$200. The quarterback has the ball. He can keep it or pitch it to another back. What is that called?
Option.
Option.
Option play.
It's an option play. Ryan?
Football 400.
I can tell you guys are big football fans.
Yeah, yeah.
Tom Landry perfected the shotgun formation with this team.
Okay, and they're all sitting there just smiling. They don't have an answer to that. Tom Landry, which team? Domity, Tom Landry, which team?
Oh, you guys are going to kill me.
Green Sammy? Bay?
Dallas Cowboys.
Dallas Dang. Cowboys.
Dallas Cowboys. Do you think we should go to commercial?
Ryan, take it out of 600.
Okay, by signaling for one of these, a returner can reel in a kick without fear of getting tackled.
Fair catch.
Fair catch, says... Cosign. Domity, Ponko, Cosign. Nicely played there, Sam Panionovich. The boys say that means fair catch.
Fair catch. Two clues left, Ryan.
800.
These penalties are simultaneous violations by the offense and defense that cancel each other out.
Okay, it's amazing to me that fair catch got you $600. This one is a little more complicated. I may ask you to play this one again, Tom. Play this cut again, because I'm thinking offensive interference, defensive interference. I mean, what does Alex Trebek want from us here?
Fair catch. Two clues left, Ryan.
800.
These penalties are simultaneous violations by the offense and defense that cancel each other out.
Okay, now we're all.
Yeah, I'm thinking interference too, John.
No,
yeah.
It'd be. I think he's more vague. They're offsetting penalties, is what he's trying to get to, right?
Sam would have said offsetting penalties,
and they are called offsetting penalties. Let's look at the $1,000 clue, just for the fun of it. Jimmy,
as Minneapolis's U.S. Bank Stadium prepares to host Super Bowl 52, I'm looking at the Ring of Honor with names from this defensive line that took the Vikings to four Super Bowls.
Okay, so this defensive line's name is what Alex is asking for. And the video that accompanied it showed the Ring of Honor inside the U.S. Bank Stadium where they're playing the Super Bowl tomorrow. And there you see the names Page, Eller, Wilbur Marshall.
Oh, yeah.
So the question is, who are these people? Domitigo.
No idea.
Good. Well, good. I mean, it's a $1,000 question, Sam.
The Purple People Eaters.
If you guys ring in and get this one, I will die. Who are the Purple People Eaters? I have to talk to them.
Yeah. So those people were all put a little bit to shame, and I do not like public shaming.
I'm just racking up all the fake money today, huh?
Really, 800, two, what is that, $3,000 or something like that?
You two, just four, up? Six is 12, eight is 20, yeah, 3,000 plus the 800 you gave me. Wow. I'm a bandit.
It's 10:17. I'm speaking today at an event in Barrington. They call it the Town Warming. It's a Chautauqua of sorts. And they sold it out and had a waiting list, not because of me, but because of some of the other people that will be speaking. You cannot buy tickets to this event, but I want you to know just a tiny bit about it. I want you to go next year when they make it much larger. And isn't it nice to know that some towns are doing something that is this engaging, that isn't all about football? Again, producer Griffin's list of movies that you might want to check out also later in this two-hour show. We're done at noon. And Chris Jones will join us before 11 o'clock at 10:35, the theater and dance critic for the Chicago Tribune. Hetty Weiss, the longtime theater critic at the Sun-Times, is out just as Richard Roper goes back in. Yeah, Roper will be back to his column despite that Twitter controversy. I'll read the statement from the Sun-Times to you in a minute. But what a shame, because I think Hetty is one of the great columnists. When you say, what's great about Chicago? I often say it's the newspapers. I say a lot of things, but we have two vibrant, vigorous, aggressive not entirely profitable newspapers in this town. And that's because of people like Hetty. Chris Jones talks a little bit about that, about Hamilton, and about some of the other shows you might take in this week or weekend. So, you know, we've all talked in this town this week about Richard Roper, the famed columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. He does movie reviews. He frequently co-hosts here on WGN Radio. And he had a weekly column for a long time that was set to renew on Tuesday. But on Monday, actually last Sunday, it was revealed that he was one of the many people who have nothing illegal about it, who purchased Twitter followers. It made their following look larger. And so, just as he was about ready to resume, they sidelined him until the Sun-Times figured it out. The Mincing Rascals, our weekly roundtable of some pretty smart people that I get to entertain, will talk about that after the 11 o'clock news. But here is the Sun-Times statement about what's happening with Richard Roper. They say, we've concluded our investigation. Roper purchased about 50,000 followers on at least six separate occasions between July 2014 and July 2016. Three of those purchases were from Devumi. That's the company the New York Times wrote about. The other three purchases were from another company. In all, Roper spent about $650 on the purchases out of his own personal account. Roper represented that these were all follower purchases that he has been able to find to Roper represented that these were all of the follower purchases that he has been able to find to date. He did not rule out other potential purchases. Roper stated that he was unaware that any of these followers were fake or had their identities compromised. Both companies, he said, portrayed themselves as promising legitimate followers. Roper cooperated with the Sun-Times. The Sun-Times had no explicit policy banning the purchase of Twitter followers. Roper is genuinely contrite, aware now that these purchases were improper. As a result of the investigation, the Sun-Times says, Roper will continue to write movie reviews. He will also write TV reviews as well as entertainment stories, but not general interest news columns. I don't know that he would have otherwise, but this makes it sound like if there's any worry about this, don't worry, folks, it'll just be TV and movies. We won't let him touch anything that's real hard news. And I don't think that's a wise way to position this, but I may be reading too much into that. Roper will continue to write movie reviews. He will also write TV reviews as well as entertainment stories, but not general interest news columns. He will start a new Twitter account, deleting his existing Twitter account shortly thereafter, and never purchase followers on any social media platform. And that they're going to have a policy now saying that nobody should purchase followers. Roper's statement begins, New York Times reportage has named me as one of many people that have purchased Twitter followers. The reports are accurate. He promises to do everything to earn your trust. And I hope that includes continuing to fill in sometimes here at WGN Radio. I'm a fan. I think he does a nice job. I don't think he should have done that. It sounds to me like all the parties involved have handled this correctly. It's 10:23, and this is WGN. Is Karen on line three? Karen Darch is the village president in Barrington. Karen, it's John Williams. You're on WGN Radio. How are you?
Fine. Good morning, John.
Yeah. Good morning to you. I'm glad it's not snowing. At least not yet for you guys.
Exactly. Yes, we're having a town warming out here, so we can't have a snowy day when we're warming up the town. So we're all about community, as you are, and we are having this event today, which is something that our forebears at Old Barrington in the late 1930s, early 40s did as sort of a speaker series. They did it back then over a couple of weeks in the dead of winter and brought in nationally and regionally prominent speakers to talk about different topics of the day. So we're recreating that this year for the first time in an all-day event, which we've called Reality Check, where we are today and our vision for the future. Mm. And we have a crowd of full house, over 120 people filling our Barrington's White House. And right now they're listening to a panel talking about our community and where we are with education and business and a couple of church leaders. And we look forward to hearing from you this afternoon.
Sounds like it's kind of a Chautauqua. We hear about these things anymore, where people gather for a weekend, hear speakers, and they do it for entertainment and education purposes. So that's kind of what you're doing here, isn't it?
It's kind of, yes, that concept. They said back in the day when this was started, it was sort of a combo of a religious revival and a town meeting, and, you know, to rekindle the spirit. And so at that time, if you think of, you know, the end of the Depression era and what was happening politically in the world, it was really important. But even today, you know, hearing about getting together and talking, even though we're in an age of mass communication and we have TV, which they didn't have then, it's still great to have people in a room listening and learning.
Well, I'll be there at 3 o'clock this afternoon speaking briefly and taking questions from the crowd about community. And I think that and maintaining a sense of community is easier and at the same time more challenging than it's ever been. You can connect with anybody, anyway, anywhere in the world, to say nothing of down the street, but we're also isolated. We're doing so in little silos. And so the title of my speech, you know, is Community. It's not a place anymore. It's a concept. And we can't lose that. And I've got a few thoughts about that I'm going to share with the crowd later this afternoon.
We are so happy to have you, and can't wait to hear what you have to offer. Thank you.
Well, good for you guys. And I know that you sold out. I know you've got a waiting list. I know it's going to be bigger next year. This is the sort of inaugural. You're bringing it back. I think it's ambitious.
Right.
I think this is high concept, unnecessary, and a really good idea. So kudos to you all for even thinking of this.
Thank you so much. We've had fun putting it together and are really excited to see the response that we've gotten this year. And yes, hope to keep doing it. So thank you so much for being a part of it. And radio commentators were a big part of those early town warmings because radio was so huge. So it's really perfect. And you have a wonderful concept about community, I know. So I can't wait to hear what you have to say.
Karen Darch is the village president in Barrington. I've enjoyed working with your staff, too. Patty and the rest of them have just been thorough, thorough, thorough. I know you know that. I will see you all later this afternoon, Karen.
Great. Thank you so much, John.
Bye now. It's 10:28. Isn't that a good idea? If you are the village president of somewhere else, or the mayor or something, do one of these. By the way, Henry Paulson, I think he's from that area, is going to be one of the speakers there. That helps to sell the event out. It's 10:28. His wife's going to be there, too. Good for them for volunteering for this. We have Chris Jones in our studio, the theater and dance critic for the Chicago Tribune. Chris, thanks for coming in. How are you?
I'm all right. Do your readers know how good you're looking? With the pocket square and your suit and... Look fabulous.
Talking to some fancy people in Barrington after the show.
Well,
so
there you go.
If it was just you and Sam,
you wouldn't be looking like that.
Hetty Weiss, your colleague at the Sun-Times, has written her last column already for the Sun-Times. She's out. What do you know about that?
Well, there you have somebody who wrote, just get this statistic, 13,000 reviews of Chicago theater and dance. 13,000. That's a lot of nights at the theater, let me tell you. Let me just say that one more time. 13,000 reviews.
13,000,
which is, you know, you add that up over the course of, I think it's a 33-year career. And, you know, she's always been a class act. There is this great tradition in Chicago of powerful women, independent-minded women writing about the theater and dance. I'm thinking of people like Claudia Cassidy, who is a great journalist at the Tribune, and then a great broadcaster also at WFMT, and a group, a whole load of others too. And Hetty is really in that tradition, and I'm just going to miss her. It won't be anywhere near as much fun without her.
Were you
on the
two,
aisle.
Are you two, I don't know what your world is like. Do you see yourselves as competitors?
Yeah, well, heck yes.
So,
oh, yeah,
but you're both going to go to the same show, and you're both going to write a review. So how do you compete? what's the competition then? To write a better review, to get it right? What?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think both of us over the years have competed for big stories. I mean, there's that. You know, we've both, Hedy as well as a critic has been a reporter, a very good one. And so we've competed to, you know which big show is coming here first, that kind of thing. And then I think, you know, it's all about what the difference of opinion is in the review and how many people are reading it and all of that.
Sure.
But, you know, we're friends as well as competitors, and I just have enormous respect for her. And she's done that job for so long, John. I mean, really a long time, like 33 years.
You wrote about it in the paper today, and I asked her yesterday to come on our show. I wasn't surprised that I haven't heard back from her. I think she'll deal with this
soon,
in her own terms. And for that matter, she'll still be on Channel 11, at least for the foreseeable future. You wrote about her in the paper today, and I thought it was nice. Weiss's tenure, marked by thousands of mostly supportive reviews and profiles, the majority of Chicago theater and dance performances and performers, but more recently of other branches of the performing arts. There were also a number of controversial reviews, many of which were bitterly opposed by some members of the local theater community.
Yes.
In that, as in other ways, Weiss fit into the long Chicago tradition of powerful, hardworking, and famously independent women writing about the arts without compromise or apology. Good on you for saying that. I'm sure she'll read those words. And I just hate to see bright voices, even if they've been here for a while, still vibrant, I hate to see them go quiet.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's a shame.
Why did the Sun Times let her go?
My understanding.
Did you see this coming? Did everybody know? I know the Sun Times has financial problems, but they were just set to rehire Richard Roper. I'm sorry to see them cut Hedy Weiss.
I did not see it coming. I had an inkling over the last few days, but I did not see it coming. I think that she, criticism has been under sort of some duress at a variety of different publications. And I also think that she is, you know, what you just read there, her independent mindedness, that, you know, that makes you maybe harder for some people to deal with. And I think some people, I think the notion of a very strong independent voice is a little more threatened now in our world, where, you know, there's more people who sort of go along to get along. I always admired her. You know, I remember this one theater. Recently a number of theaters got so mad at what she'd written that they tried to stop her from getting tickets, essentially. And I was opposed to that. I remain opposed to that notion. But nonetheless, that's what went on. And so the Sun-Times said, essentially, well, we'll buy a ticket, which is what you'd hope your paper would do, right? What if someone says, we don't want John Williams at this, you'd say to GN, I'm going anyway, and we'll buy a ticket. No problem. No one should necessarily get a free ticket, but you shouldn't be stopped from going. So anyway, she buys a ticket to this theater that had really said some horrible things about her in public, I might add. And she went to a show and she gave it this glowing review and walked out, you know, walked out and then filed a review. It's a glowing review. And I thought to myself, I don't think I could have done that. I would have been like, you know, to heck with you. I'm not going to that show. And I was like, that is the definition of me of professionalism.
And what a challenge that must be to your aesthetic. I mean, so you're trying to review a show fairly.
Yes.
Am I being too kind because I want to mend fences?
Yes.
Am I too tough on them because I'm ticked?
Yes.
It's hard. It's a challenge maybe to find your voice in a situation like that. I didn't see that review, but I sure was going to ask you if you think her departure had anything to do with the criticism that she and the Sun-Times took. You don't think this was them saying this is a liability that we don't need anymore?
I don't know. My hunch is that some of that played into it. I think, you know, they did publish a front page editorial in support of Hedy. So if we take them at their word, they
stood by. Yeah, and then 8 months later, they said goodbye.
Right, exactly.
But exactly. I suppose those are separate issues.
Maybe.
I sure hope so.
Yeah.
Hamilton is in Denver.
Yes.
I think it's there for about 6 weeks.
Yes.
My brother lives in Denver.
There you go.
He and his wife really wanted to see Hamilton. So they went online to buy tickets and realized that in order to get tickets to Hamilton, guess what you had to do?
Buy tickets to about 10 other shows.
Yes. So they spent $1,700 for two season passes to the theater where it's showing.
Yeah.
But that was the only way to get Hamilton tickets.
That happened here a little bit. That was, you know, I was actually advising people who really wanted tickets to Hamilton. I said, you know, this is not, listeners should know this is not a current opportunity because that moment passed. But I said, you should buy a season ticket because it was cheaper than paying the scalpers prices. You may as well buy all those other shows.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Buy the whole season. That's still better
still
than
what, better than one ticket from some guy.
Well,
you know?
So I haven't finished the story yet. So now he's out $1,700 to see Hamilton and seven other shows he doesn't want to see. And then he goes online to see what the scalped tickets cost. That is, people that are peeling that ticket off.
Right.
Okay. We're talking now about Hamilton. So my brother in Denver buys two season passes to the theater out there. He gets eight shows each for he and his wife. It's $1,700, but that's the only way to get tickets.
Right.
Then he goes online, and he sees the people are peeling them off. And while the two season passes cost them combined $1,700, he can get $1,800 each for just the Hamilton ticket.
Wow.
So there's a call to conscience. You're like, well, I started this enterprise to go see Hamilton.
Right.
I'm now staring a profit of $1,900 in the face. Profit if I don't go to Hamilton.
Right. I know what I'd be doing, and he wouldn't be Hamilton.
That's what he did. So he typed me back, and he goes, I win, because Brenda and I are going Wednesday here for the first time in Chicago. We bought our tickets. He goes, I win. I go, yeah, but you ain't seeing Hamilton. So I know you're happy to have scored a couple grand, but we paid. Brenda and I, online, were able to buy tickets. I don't know if people realize this. Hamilton seems like this unobtainable thing, but we got the tickets 2 weeks out. We could have spent $400 on the best seats in the house or about $180 for very good seats next to them. The end of the story is for less than $400, B and I will see the show this week in the evening.
You could fly your brother. You know what? How much is a round trip from Denver? You could bring him in.
I said, take your $1,900.
Get on a plane. Take him to Chicago. It's probably a better production, too.
And they are.
Right. There we go.
So you've seen Hamilton four times.
Yeah.
Is it good every time?
Yeah. I mean, it's varied over the years. We had, in the very early days of the Chicago production, there was this guy, Joshua Henry, who played Aaron Burr, who is fantastic. And he's now going into Carousel on Broadway with all kinds of Jesse Mueller and all kinds of starry people, Audra McDonald and goodness knows who. So he's like gone and a huge star. And then Wayne Brady was, I saw Wayne Brady play that same role quite differently from Joshua. And, you know, it's varied. And of course, I saw Lynn do it too. Lynn is not a great performer, a great writer, great composer. But I, you know, I always thought I like Miguel, who plays the role here. Who's still, it's the same. So if you go to see Hamilton this week, it's the same Hamilton. The guy playing Alexander Hamilton is the same guy who opened the show. So he's moved to Chicago. He has he's you know, very much involved in kids' charities here. He's a great guy, lovely man, and he's been here the duration. So I don't think he's going anywhere as long as that show runs. And I think it's got about another year, but they claim longer than that. But I think it'll be here about another year.
Well, if they're saying we'll be here till January of 2019,
yeah.
And you think it might be here longer than that?
That's what the producer, Jeffrey Seller, I wrote a piece in the paper saying, I think Hamilton's got about another year, and he was called me up and said, no, wrong. It's we're going to be here much longer than
you,
that.
Theater critics are getting yelled at all the time.
All the time.
What was the review of you after you panned the performance of Joseph in the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat in the suburbs?
Well, I got like a lot of grief for that.
It's showing at the Lincoln?
The Drury Lane. The Drury Lane in Oak Brook Terrace, and it is a polarizing show. So Joseph is a beloved show in Chicago. It played for years with the great Donny Osmond.
Saw Donny
moved to Wilmette, I think, and put his kids in school back in the day.
Seriously?
Yeah.
It was that kind of commitment.
He did. I think he was here for 3 years or something.
Brenda
like
saw
that.
Donny. I don't know if I saw Donny do it. I don't remember if I did, but what a great show.
I have this image in my head. It suddenly popped in my head of I saw Donnie and Marie do a show, and this is not that long ago. And Donnie like crowd surfed the audience. He got out in the audience, and the people were like passing Donny Osmond. And I remember thinking, wow, you really must like this dude after all these years to be out there.
Listen,
being crowd surfed.
We do. We love our Donnie and we love our Marie. And I think you can validate
absolutely
that.
Right. Those are, but the, you know, they're in that school of performers who just live to perform. That's what they do. That's what they have. But my other story with him is once I was calling him up for an interview, and I was doing it from home, and I left. I went to the 7-Eleven or something like that, and I said to my wife, oh, you know, come with me. We're going to grab a couple of groceries. And she leaves. She's a huge Donny Osmond fan. She leaves. And then he calls, and he's there on the answer phone. And she goes, if I had not left the house, she was so mad. I would have talked to Donny Osmond. Anyway, this Joseph does not have Donny Osmond, and it's set in Vegas. Now, okay, so just put your head around that for a second. Joseph, Old Testament story, we're in Vegas. Okay, all right, well, we can maybe go with that. But the issue for me is that when you're in Vegas, you're in a sort of an R-rated environment. Just, that's Vegas. No one likes Vegas more than me. But I'm not taking a 7-year-old, you know. And so I felt a little bit like that title, inevitably, people are going to bring their kids, people are going to bring their grandkids to it. And I felt it was a bit of a bait and switch.
Well, the music is... Are they singing different songs?
No, they're singing the same songs.
But you said that they sing them in a different style or fashion.
Well, right. So the premise of the show is that the narrator, if you remember, the narrator in Joseph is traditionally like a sort of charming young woman who sort of smiles at the kids and that sort of thing. The performer they have, quite a competent performer. She's a celebrity impersonator. So she does Britney. She does Celine Dion. She does Beyonce. She does all the Vegas acts, right? Shania Twain. So the score is sung as if it were Britney and Shania Twain.
I got it.
If that's your thing. But I'm like, you know, is that really Joseph?
It's not your thing. two and a half stars today at the Marriott for in Lincolnshire for, what's the name
Ragtime.
Of the show?
Ragtime. Yeah, Ragtime.
Hello, Ragtime.
Yeah, Ragtime. That's not a bad show. That's, this beautiful musical. I found it a little bleak. You know, Ragtime is an incredibly hopeful show. That's another show that had enormous history in Chicago. You know, it was here at the, it was the reason that the Oriental Theater, which is the sort of cornerstone of our theater district, that's why it was, you know, restored. Ragtime, it played for years. The great Garth Dobrinsky, this Canadian producer who had famously had two sets of books. He had the real set, and then he had the set he showed the tax people.
Really?
And they finally, you know, I don't believe he's coming back to the U.S. anytime soon. But because he had all that money, because he was cooking the books, it was a great show.
I didn't know that's how the Oriental got redone.
Yeah.
God bless him for that.
Sorted past to the Oriental.
Hey, the Super Bowl is going to be this weekend. Yeah. Will you be watching the halftime show? And as a theater critic, do you look at it with a different eye than the rest of us?
I always enjoy that. You know, I sort of love reviewing those ads. I think those are great.
But, you know, Katy Perry dancing with sharks.
Oh, the show.
Or for that matter, Justin Timberlake said he's going to do something at this show this year that's never been done before.
So no Janet Jackson. So Janet Jackson's not showing up.
Well, maybe he's going to put the thing back on her breast. And that's a whole nother conversation about their careers after that moment. I still maintain it was an accident.
It's the moment that popularized the phrase wardrobe malfunction.
Totally.
Nobody knew what, which is a standard theater. That's what you say in the theater when something goes wrong.
Really?
Like,
now?
Fall down.
But that was...
No, even prior to that, it was sort of said,
I hadn't heard it before.
You walk out on stage, John Williams' pants fall down, you go, wardrobe malfunction. And then it sort of flew into the popular consciousness where it has remained.
Well, if we see something extraordinary, stagecraft-wise, on Sunday, I'll call you Monday or Tuesday and ask for your review.
I'll look forward to it.
And hopefully it won't be anything like that. I don't know, maybe it will be. The ramifications from the Janet Jackson, Justin Timberlake incident were amazing. Broadcast shows then had to start tape delaying.
Yeah.
Literally, their radio programs so that somebody else could listen to them, make sure no bad words were said. Forget about showing a breast. And only in America, by the way, would we be so offended.
Right.
I mean, I know it's family viewing and it was inappropriate, but good Lord, was the reaction not commensurate.
What do you think now if that happened now? Do you think it would be the same, or do you think it's...
Well, right now we are super sensitive, maybe appropriately so. I don't know what the right reaction is, but I think that if it's an accident, which I always maintained it was, like I have inside information, that we should treat it as such, not as a crime, and not as a mark to move the broadcast industry around. It was just weird. You should read Chris Jones' stories in the paper today, both about this show in Lincolnshire, about Hedy Weiss. And I'm glad that they reprinted your review of All My Sons, too.
That's a great show, Core Theater.
Yeah. At least in brief. Yeah, thanks for coming in.
It's my pleasure, John. Always a pleasure.
Read Chris Jones in the Chicago Tribune. Thank you, Doma T. John Williams, Mincing Rascals in a couple of seconds, but you played a little of The Temptations. When it's cold. Your newscast, and now I got The Temptations on my mind. R.I.P. I just posted Dennis Edwards.
Yes.
And in fact, on Facebook, I included a link to The Temptations singing Papa Was a Rolling Stone on Soul Train.
Classy.
In 1972. Oh my God, how much fun is that?
Classic. And I can't hear this song without smiling, John.
The clothes, the dance moves, the voices, the choreography. Awesome. Awesome.
Iconic.
Awesome. So you'll surf around probably this weekend and do a little bit of that if I can make it easier for you. At least there, Papa Was a Rolling Stone from Soul Train is on my Facebook page. I'm WGN King John. Each week on Thursday afternoons here at WGN Radio, technically at 11:11 in the morning, we record a podcast called The Mincing Rascals. It's always me and Steve Bertrand, Steve from WGN Radio News and the Wintrust Business Hour. And then our friends from the Chicago Tribune, Eric Zorn, the columnist, Kristen McQuarrie, who writes editorials, and Scott Stantis, who is the editorial cartoonist. And we kick around a variety of subjects. That's The Mincing Rascals. I think it's really good, and it's because these people are so good on it. And I hope that you listen to it and share it with your friends. So this week, in part, the gang talked about the president's State of the Union address. I asked them all to grade it from an A to an F, and Kristen McQuarrie went first.
A.
Scott?
A content, B minus. In terms of delivery and so on, sort of like a C.
How about you?
I would say probably C's across the board.
Steve Bertrand?
I didn't watch all of it, so I'll give him a B.
I gave him a B minus. Look at that. We're all kind of in unison. He did pretty good.
Well, but it's the most controlled event there is. I don't know. It's not a really high bar here.
It's not a high wire act, but he's gone off script before. I think Stephen Miller wrote the speech, but he agreed with it, and that could have been disastrous, or like I said, it could have just been more dystopian. It could have been darker and angrier, like his inaugural speech was, and it wasn't.
I was just gonna say the thing I hate, and it became a thing under Reagan, and this is just like taking it to a next level, is using people as props, especially the couple. The one that really got to me was the couple that who were their children were victims.
Mm-hmm.
An illegal alien, and this is supposed to be a time for statesmanship and a time for high rhetoric, and there was none of that. The man seems completely and totally and utterly unable to express empathy. So in order to do that, he used these other people to do it it was 80 minutes long.
They've been doing it since Ronald Reagan, and it needs to stop. They're using these people as a prop. Some of them were very emotional. The North Korean dissident.
Oh, that was amazing. That was a good moment.
But still, it doesn't quite belong there, and they are using those people.
By the way, they're called Skutniks. If you want to use the term of art.
Skutnik was the first one.
He was the guy who jumped into the river.
Skutniks.
But as for the substance of the speech, that and the words that were written, so clearly they were thoughtful and meant. The phrase, Americans are dreamers too, was bothersome to me. Him pointing out that those two couples who lost their daughters pointed out that those people, I don't know what his exact language was.
He insinuated that they were victims of illegal aliens.
He insinuated that they were DACA people, right?
Or
dreamers. To qualify for DACA, you have to be free of any past crime. I just don't understand where he is on the dreamers and all of this, because he'll talk about love, love, love. And then he'll stand in the well and say, Americans are dreamers too.
See, I generally get annoyed with the pointing at the Joe the plumber in the audience, but I thought they did a really good job of vetting and finding really compelling stories. And to say that they're props, that's to say that they don't know exactly why they're sitting in those chairs, that they aren't functioning adults. I think people who have lost loved ones to people who are illegally in the country, that's a story that doesn't get told a lot. We have Dreamers on our front page. We tell their stories all the time. This is a story that doesn't get told a lot. And so I didn't mind it. I thought it was touching.
You're describing dupes. They weren't duped into it. They obviously knew exactly what they were going
to
do, but they still
there.
Could have been props.
Well, you're another calling one, them props, I mean.
But I'm saying a prop is different. You're implying that they were duped into doing it. I'm saying they did know it, but they still were scenery for the speech. You know, and the other one, the beautiful story about the police officer and his wife who
adopted the baby.
I mean, they're wonderful stories.
Scott's right. This president is unable to express empathy, so he sort of put it on these people. They stood there and for 49 seconds wept, both couples, as the galley applauded them because we don't know what else to do. It's like liking somebody on Facebook when they post a terrible story because it's all you've got. It's a blunt instrument. And then the president said, thank you, you may be seated. And then he said, all of our hearts are breaking for you. And people applauded some more. And I thought, this is crushing for these people.
Let me just say this. On Facebook, there are little emojis now you can use instead of just like. When someone says, you know, my father passed away, you don't have to have like like. You can,
well, the Congress didn't have an emoji to express what needed to be done there.
They need some emojis in the room.
Well, they have Nancy Pelosi's face.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's about as close to
a look at emoji. Wow. Wait a minute.
I want to circle back to what Kristen said about. But I want to circle back to what Kristen said about the story about people being killed by people who are here illegally. That story has been told. Maybe it hasn't been told enough. But the question is, are immigrants more likely to commit crimes than American citizens? And the answer seems to be no. And so the purpose of telling that story seems to me to be to inflame anti-immigrant sentiment in general. I mean, you can use that kind of logic on just about any to make just about any kind of point you want to. And the thing is, when Democrats try to make that point about guns, Republicans run
away
screaming.
Did you object when at the Democratic National Convention, Hillary Clinton had a bunch of mothers who lost their kids to police? Did you find that objectionable? Did you call them props?
I would still call them props. And the definition of a prop is something up there to help further a point. They were they duped? They weren't duped. They knew they were there. Is there a difference between a convention speech and a State of the Union speech? I think there probably is. I want to be clear. I thought those were touching stories. I thought they were remarkable stories. I want it to end for all of them.
Plus, when you watch the speech, didn't you get the feeling that of all of the things that the president should report to the Congress and us about, I guess immigration is one of them, but good grief, health care and taxes, and you just go on the litany of things that are pressing or important to this country. The dangers of immigrants was far and away presented to us as the most important concern of Americans. I don't believe that at all. People are not threatened by immigrants. Their jobs aren't threatened by immigrants. Their safety isn't threatened by immigrants. But that was the boogeyman that the president was going to save us from in that speech. And I thought it was almost a red herring. The House Intelligence Committee is looking into links between the Trump campaign and Russia. I'm asking you guys, should we all see this research memo, give it the light of day?
Yeah, why not?
Yes.
When would we ever argue against
because it's never happened before
more.
And because maybe these things are better done in a contained setting?
Because they say it will compromise intelligence gathering?
Since when has the press that jumps at every leak and every unsubstantiated comment, the media has been so hungry to take any sort of unsubstantiated information, and now all of a sudden we're putting the brakes on a congressman's memo that the Democrats can come back and say this is completely tainted, he is partisan.
Well, so Democrats shift then, says, all right, here's my 10-page memo on what
right,
I feel about it.
And
they won't let him.
They voted not to release that along party lines.
And they also, the committee also voted not to listen to the FBI director who wanted to come in and talk.
Kristen, the FBI director wanted to come before the committee and make the case of why this memo was damaging to national security. And they said, no,
we don't want to hear.
Because they're still going through the process. This is the process of releasing classified documents.
Is this the way a White House or a Republican Party would be behaving? Is this consonant with innocence? I mean, it seems like all of this behavior, these distractions are throwing up, all suggest that they know that Donald Trump is guilty of something pretty bad, and they're really doing everything they can to save his
butt. I don't know that it says that. I do think what it says is that people in those positions, and Kristen touched on it perfectly, don't like transparency. If anytime they use the argument of transparency or the people's right to know, they're lying. This is one of those instances. It makes me crazy that, yes, I think government that is as transparent as you can make it is the best government. How many times have we heard over the last 60 years, if you release this, it will compromise Americans' ability to
Just let the chips fall where they may. Let the committee do its work, and then we can vet it afterwards.
They don't want him to talk to Robert Mueller because they know, everybody knows, this guy cannot talk for 2 hours without telling a lie, a huge lie. And he's going to get
a beautiful lie.
They call it a perjury trap, but it's not a trap.
It's not a trap if you tell the truth.
He'll just commit perjury on his own.
Think about that. Asking the president to sit down and speak honestly to a congressional committee is a perjury trap. It is if you perjure yourself. Every conversation then becomes a perjury trap.
Having been a victim of speed traps, I know that I have to speed in order to get caught.
Okay, I want to ask you guys about something different now. Let's go to Chicago and Illinois. The Sun-Times columnist and film critic Richard Roper was set to renew his twice-a-week column this week, but the paper sidelined him because, it looks like, some of Roper's 225,000 followers are not real on Twitter. They are Twitter bots, fake accounts. The New York Times outed Roper and others on a page one story on Sunday about how easy it is to buy followers to make your digital footprint look bigger. What should the Sun-Times do?
My thought is they should have him write a mea culpa column, and they should have him delete that account and start again on Twitter. I think this is a fairly serious bit of deception, but probably not a career death penalty bit of deception. But I also have to say that I've had every conversation I've had this week has come back to this topic, and people, make a variety of different arguments, and I'm spun by some of them. I'm not exactly sure where I come down on how grave this is, so I'm interested to hear what the other rascals have to say.
I had a conversation with the guy who was in charge of, and when I bring him into the studio sometime, you can actually hit him in the face if you want, because he worked it upworthy and came up with the, "You won't believe what happened next," headline. His job is audience development. I passed the story to him because I wanted to know what he felt, and he was actually very different than Eric. He thought it was no blood, no foul. But then someone else followed through. I think they posted on your Facebook page, didn't they, Eric? Where they said there are some people who get speaking engagements and they actually do profit from saying, "I have 225,000 Twitter followers."
Oh, it's bad. No, Scott, it's bad. It's deceptive.
Why?
He bought Twitter followers, and he hasn't denied that, and I think it's probably true, but it's bad. The question is how bad
it is. It's lying on your resume is what it is.
Yeah.
And
okay,
you may be qualified for the job you're applying for. You may be good at it, and he is. Roper's dynamite. I'm a fan of his work,
yeah,
and
too.
I will be, but that's a lie on your resume.
It's only lying on your resume if you're using it to get a job. And no, it is,
okay,
John.
Fine. I mean, or a raise, or a promotion, or a new gig.
Yeah, if you're using it,
that's inherent on the cover page.
Let me tell you something. I am in big trouble in my house because of my view on this. I'm a little confused about it. I don't still know exactly where I am, but I consider it almost marketing. I mean, I almost consider it like
wearing a nice suit.
Like what if you're running a business and you are in debt, up to your eyeballs, but you spend all your money on a beautiful facade to get people to come in and pay attention to you. And in one way or another, I keep going back to that. I feel that way. I serious businesses that hire influencers, which is what we're talking about, know there are different ways to measure engagement on social media than just by the number of followers. You look at retweets, you look at the engagement of the audience after something.
You can buy retweets too.
Well, maybe you can.
We're making a lot of dotted lines here. If there's no connection between him personally profiting off of this, then I really don't see what the big deal is. I don't. I see it like putting something up on Facebook and then you can hit that little boost button and you can pay extra to reach more people. I don't see that's like a suspendable offense.
I guess that's not. But this really is a little more concocted than that. I thought the problem was going to be that if you're willing to fudge your follower numbers because that makes you look better, are you not also able to then go down the slippery slope of fudging facts or contacts or interviews?
I think it's like fudging. I think it's like fudging the columnist's picture. I do mean that. Have you seen the ones of Eric that didn't make the paper? No, but I understand the argument that it's dishonest. I guess I don't judge the influence just by the number of followers.
There's something weird about it too, because Richard Roper's a popular guy. He's a nationally known movie critic. I saw some audit where like 98,000 of his followers are actually legitimate. That's like five or six times more than I have. I mean, it's like he's a popular guy. He doesn't need to buy followers. There's something sort of it's like it'd be like if I wore elevator shoes, right? Like, why would I do that?
You know? It's a little whorish. Can I say that? It's a little whorish. But I don't see it as. I don't know. It's not.
I think part of the problem too, for those of us in the public that are commenting on it, is that we're trying to separate or need to. Our own envy for a quarter of a million followers when I've been pounding away, trying to be engaged, trying to be provoking.
You know what?
And I have 3,000 or 2,000.
I have real followers, and all you have to do is write one really inflammatory column that goes around the world.
And then you get all the haters
and you get,
follow
there you.
You
go. So be really offensive.
So what you're saying is we need that inflammatory moment.
You do. You have to have just one really big mistake, and then you'll...
She's not kidding. I wouldn't characterize it as a mistake. That's Krista McQuarrie and the gang and the Mincing Rascals podcast. We recorded that about 48 hours ago. If a couple of the points seem slightly dated. In fact, what Eric Zorn said should happen is exactly what the Sun-Times and Richard Roper are going to do. The account gets deleted. It gets restarted. He won't do it again. They're changing the policy so that nobody can buy or is supposed to buy Twitter followers at the Sun-Times, and Roper will be back in the paper where he should be. It's 11:23, but Kristen did that. She wrote a column a year ago or so, and it made a point, and a lot of people were upset about it, and it went national, and the hell that she took for that was upsetting to her and her friends and family. It was tough, and I guess that's, you know, the life that we all choose to lead. If you're going to be if your brand, if your product is thought, if it's opinion, then you have to be able to take it back. But that doesn't mean you like it. And she got a lot of followers for that, and not all of them, it sounds like, did she want. It's 11:24. That's the Mincing Rascals podcast. And I hope that you listen to it. Pick it up wherever you listen to find our podcasts, and do share it with your friends. Tom Rush is our producer today, and for Griffin. Tom, did you find out, does anybody know what it is that Justin Timberlake has up his sleeve? He said something's going to happen this weekend that's never happened before at the Super Bowl, entertainment-wise.
Well, we know what it's not. We know that he's not planning on bringing out Janet Jackson for a repeat, and we know that he's not planning on bringing out NSYNC, his old boy band from the 90s.
They've denied both of those, huh?
Yeah.
Janet would have been a nice touch. I think that would have been appropriate. I would have liked, you know, I know the NFL doesn't want to go there, but good Lord, we're past it, and she's due something anyway. So we don't know, huh?
I'm waiting for the Purple Rain cover.
It's in Minnesota, where it is snowing right now. It will be snowing hard. The coldest Super Bowl on record. It's indoors, mind you, but never before has a host city been so cold as Minnesota is today. They've been waiting for this weekend for about 3 years. When Minneapolis was awarded the Super Bowl, the stadium in which they were playing had not yet even been built. And so it's just been this mad community rush up there to get to today and tomorrow. And they have skyways. Everything is connected by these second-story tunnels, but they were hoping that it wasn't going to be this cold. You know, we long debated. I worked up there for 4 years once and 4 years again, can you tell? But the debate for a long time was, well, would it be awesome if it was snowy and 5 degrees and the world would get the true Minnesota embrace, or would it be better if we gave them like 28 or 33 and sunny? They're getting the former. And then some. It's snowing pretty hard up there. Just had a friend of mine just a couple of minutes ago. So hopefully the game will be good. And hopefully the halftime show will be good. We're all JT fans around here, right? Brian Gaw had a first-person piece in the Chicago Tribune over the weekend. It was first published in the Washington Post, or actually earlier this week. Did you guys see the Brian Gaw story? Do you remember 2 years ago? Do I have the audio of Katy Perry when she performed 2 years ago as the principal performer for the halftime show? She just looked fantastic, all bright and shiny.
With the Sharks!
And she was doing this song with a couple of foam sharks. Dancers in 6-foot foam costumes that looked like sharks. One shark was on the right, one shark was on the left. Hey, sports boy, which was the most famous shark as a result?
Left shark.
Left shark! So Left Shark had a first-person piece in the Tribune this week.
He revealed himself.
He said it was the 2015 Super Bowl, we had been rehearsing for a month, 5 or 6 days a week, 8 to 10 hours a day. I would need to slip into a 7-foot-tall blue shark costume for Katy Perry's number, Teenage Dream. So Katy Perry's up there dancing around doing Teenage Dream. It's got kind of a beach feel, I guess. For some reason, there's these two giant 7-foot blue and white dancing sharks on either side of her. And Gaw writes, no matter how many times we rehearsed this routine, I knew I could not go on autopilot. The Super Bowl is the biggest stage there is, a dream for every dancer. And this was it. Now I had to give it. After I danced, so he dances, and for about 4 or 5 seconds, while he is in unison with Katie and Right Shark, he kind of grooves out a little bit. He does a few fancy steps that weren't part of the original choreography. And the world noticed it and loved it. The sharks were fun anyway. The whole thing was delightful. And then to see the one left shark go off script a little bit was just fantastic. He said, after I danced, the cast and I watched the rest of the halftime show from the sidelines. And we were back at our hotel by the fourth quarter. By then, I already had friends texting me, please tell me you were one of the sharks. And I replied that, yes, I was. Which one? They wanted to know. I had no idea. It wasn't until the next morning that I began to understand what had happened. We were on the first flight out of Arizona to Burbank, California. I'd gotten up at 6 a.m. When I got on the plane and turned my phone back on, or off the plane and turned my phone back on, my entire voicemail box was full. Every major network, newspaper, every agent had called, and they all wanted to talk to Left Shark. I still had no idea how they got my phone number. Doing something rogue at the Super Bowl is not an option. The NFL does not play around. Ask Janet Jackson. And it was really only a few seconds, a snippet, maybe 4 or 5 counts, when I improvised in my costume. But people went crazy. The phenomenon of Left Shark was born. I'd worked with major artists, including Miley Cyrus, Lady Gaga. I danced in all the major award shows and in movies. I'd been dancing with Katy Perry for nearly 5 years. Just because you're working with a pop star doesn't mean you aren't presenting an art piece. Improvisation is part of our job. All of my fellow dancers and I had grown up watching Michael Jackson and Prince at the Super Bowl, and we'd all dreamed of being part of that halftime show. To perform with an artist at the peak of her career was a dream come true. I think people were so attached to Left Shark because America loves an underdog. They love to root for one. The Super Bowl is a machine, so heavily planned and executed, and then along came this goofball. It gave people something to connect to. At the end, he writes, "It's been 3 years, and we're still talking about Left Shark. I'm glad it makes people happy. These performances should be uplifting and joyful. It did change my life. I didn't become a millionaire, but I had lived one of the biggest dreams any dancer could imagine. It was an experience I'll have forever. I hope other people keep following their dreams, keep growing, and never stop being afraid to be that quintessential Left Shark." Wrote Brian Gaw in Friday, February 2nd's Chicago Tribune.
Did you see the TMZ report, by the way?
No.
That Prince's hologram will make an appearance?
Maybe that's what Timberlake was referring to. Mm-hmm. Maybe the never seen before. Yeah, I'll bet that's it, huh, Sam?
Probably.
It's not JT. It's that Prince, who is bigger now than he was just before he died in Minneapolis. And he was huge then. He was huge then. I don't know, like, who comes from Chicago? Michael Jordan, Oprah Winfrey, pick them. I don't know how close we feel to either of our icons there or some of the others. But Minnesota loves Prince. And when he passed away, that state mourned for weeks. And they're still hanging on to him. So that's kind of cool. Snowing up there. It's 11:47. The latest about Brenda and I went to see I, Tonya last night. There's a story in the New York Times about what Tonya Harding says about I, Tonya, about a song about her in the movie, and about how they did some of the things in that movie. You know, Tonya Harding did not perform in the movie. Margot Robbie plays her, and Robbie looks like she's really skating in the movie. So how did they make that happen? Plus, producer Griff's 7 flicks for you coming up.
Are your laces untied?
Are your laces untied?
Frown on your face for...
We talked about this a few weeks ago, Sufjan Stevens' ode to Tanya Harding, which came out last year. I'm reading from W Magazine. Tanya Harding, who has been back in the news since Margot Robbie played her in the new film I, Tanya, has some strong thoughts about Sufjan Stevens' song named after her, despite never having listened to it. In a lengthy New York Times profile, the famed figure skater, whose career ended after she pled guilty to hindering the prosecution in a trial involving her rival Nancy Kerrigan, Kerrigan was clubbed in the knee by her ex-husband's hired hand, Sean Eckert. Tanya is speaking out about her portrayal in the media. When asked about her thoughts on Stevens' recently released song, Tanya Harding, the athlete who now goes by her married name, Tanya Price, said, "She has no interest in it. Who gives these people permission to use my name?" she said. "You all discredited me and it hurt. I'm a human being and it hurt my heart. I was a liar to everybody, but still, 23 years later, finally, everybody can just eat crow. That's what I have to say." Ironically, Price's New York Times profile ends with the author writing, "With her head against my chest, I leaned down and hugged her. Here is something I'll never understand, that you can be sitting across the table from someone who certainly did something bad, who appears to show no remorse for it, and yet you still feel the Oxycontin rush of love and sympathy for her." And then the author, to her, quotes a couple of lines from that Sufjan Stevens song, and she smiles, she likes it, not realizing that the song that she just dissed was what was just quoted to her. Margot Robbie seems to really capture that essence of Tanya Harding in the movie I, Tanya. Brendan and I saw it last night. It was really good. Wasn't the best movie I saw this year, but it was sure worth the $12. But you cannot believe that that's Margot Robbie doing the skating, because we're seeing these triple axels or triple Lutzes, these spin jumps in the air. But son of a gun, that's Margot Robbie, and here's what they did. First of all, Robbie committed to skating 5 days a week for 5 months, so that when you do see her skating some simple moves and gracefully glide across the ice, that's really Margot Robbie. Then they had 2 stunt doubles, and the stunt doubles would do some long shots, although really everything's very close. And then they took the 3D of Margot Robbie's head and they inserted it on top of them. And you know that when you're watching a close-up of Margot Robbie do a triple spin in the air and you're watching it, that's not Margot Robbie, and that her head must have been stuck on a body that did it. But you don't see the lines. It's amazingly convincing. And it's amazing how stupid her husband and his friends were in the movie. We asked producer Griffin to review movies for us. He's doing a movie a day this year. And the last 7 he reviewed for us, they're all on my Facebook page. I'm King John, WGN King John on Facebook, are The Shape of Water, The Myth of the American Sleepover, Molly's Game, Bright, Pariah, The Shop Around the Corner, yeah, with Jimmy Stewart, and My Life as a Zucchini. Not all of these movies brand new, all of them new to Griffin, so you get a fresh look at 7 films. About The Shop Around the Corner, he wrote, "I was grinning the whole time. This is such a treat. I was surprised to see that the romantic leads worked in the same store, unlike in the remake You've Got Mail, where they owned competing businesses. The set is gorgeous. Margaret Sullivan is really funny. Jimmy Stewart is Jimmy Stewart." All 7 of them are on my Facebook page. Here's one more. Molly's Game. Aaron Sorkin's directorial debut is overwritten by Aaron Sorkin to within an inch of its life. Jessica Chastain's voiceover narration is constant and rapid fire, but Sorkin has not lost his knack for patter. There's something pretty irresistible about this story of a woman creating an environment where she controls many rich, powerful, stupid men. All on Facebook. I'm King John there. WGN King John on Facebook. Amy Guth's in our studio. What are you going to do on your Wintrust? Is it the Wintrust business lunch or is it just the business lunch?
It is the Wintrust business lunch.
Wintrust has their name on this hour too. Thank you, Wintrust. What are you doing today?
Well, we're going to start things off talking about how as we see more and more ride sharing
happening. There's some congestion woes going along with that.
Oh, I love this
you
subject
don't
because
say.
I run into it every day.
Yeah.
Hey, Uber drivers, you can't stop in the middle of a crowded street.
Well, and there has been some regulation around Michigan Avenue even, so you can't, rideshare drivers can't let passengers off right here on Michigan Avenue.
I ran into that yesterday. I was in the elevator with a woman. She says, I'm getting an Uber. I said, well, just go in front of the Tribune Tower. She said, they won't pick me up there.
Yeah.
I said, you're kidding.
Or drop off.
So then she had to go down to lower Michigan Avenue, which some people don't know how to get to.
Right, because if you summon a ride from there, you're going to be
know?
Waiting.
It
doesn't
yeah. know. You better not do that if you're by the Tribune Tower. So that, give me another topic.
Yeah, so we're going to be talking about that, and then we're going to talk a little bit about Super Bowl ads, of course, because that's always a very big topic and kind of themes we're going to see emerge. And we're going to have Senior Vice President and Wealth Advisor with Morgan Stanley in Lake Forest, Stephen Esposito. He's going to come in and talk a little bit with us about the January jobs report and help us look at that data and make sense of it a bit.
Wasn't it amazing? So the jobs numbers were good, very good, and wages go up, which is what we've all been waiting for. That may trigger inflation, and so the market gives up 700 points on the Dow yesterday.
Yeah.
That was a kick in the gut, and I'm trying to find some perspective on that. I asked Susie Sunshine, who comes on mm-hmm. with Ro Khan on Fridays, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Like, maybe we should not be greedy, take the 700 hit on the Dow, and trade it for higher wages
right.
and more jobs. I don't know the answer to that question.
People way above our pay grades, I think, are working on that.
I'm just proud of myself for thinking of it.
Right.
I don't know what the answer is, but maybe your guest would have something to say about that.
Yeah, I have questions about that, too. So what? You have a pocket square happening today.
It was really upsetting to Chris Jones as well. He was on earlier. I'm speaking in Barrington. I'll get out of here in about 60 seconds. I'll go to Barrington at their White House. It's a center in Barrington. It's next to the Egg Harbor. And at 3 o'clock, I'm going to give a brief 30-minute talk about the importance of community.
Oh,
they're
wonderful.
Doing kind of a Chautauqua over there.
Okay.
And they used to do it in the 1930s. They haven't done it since. They're bringing it back today. I'm one of the speakers.
How nice.
Yeah.
Well, that'll be fun.
Yeah. So, hence the pocket square.
Well, it's working for you. It looks good. It's very dapper.
Hey, thanks, Tom Hush, for producing the show today. Doma T. Pongo. Sam Panayotovich, we love you, my friend.
Thank you, King John.